It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Well, spring training is underway in Florida and Arizona, so let's talk some baseball today, in particular Cincinnati Reds baseball, Cincinnati Reds history, with Greg Rhodes. He's the former executive director of the Reds Hall of Fame and Museum. He retired from that position in 2007, but continues to serve as the Reds team historian and remains active through speaking engagements and interviews, such as this one. He's been the host of Reds Hall of Fame highlight moments heard before each Reds game on the Reds Radio Network pregame show. He has co-authored 6 books on the Cincinnati Reds, including Red Leg Journal and Reds in Black and White, both winners of the Sporting News Sabre Baseball Research Award. He worked for the Cincinnati Historical Society from 1987 to 92. He helped plan the new History Museum at the Cincinnati Museum Center. He also served as a former president of the Board of Historic Southwest Ohio. He's been the chairman of the local chapter of the Society for American Baseball Research, that's Sabre, and is past president of the Cincinnati Red Stockings vintage baseball team. In this interview, we talked with him about the original Cincinnati Red Stockings of 1869, baseball's first true above-board professional team, and also the Crosley Field era, especially the 1950s and 1960s, a great period in Reds baseball. Here's our conversation with Greg Rhodes. Greg, you've served with the Hall of Fame as executive director and now have been a team historian for the Reds for several years. This seems like what a matchup for somebody who grew up around here, or in this general area anyway, maybe from Indiana. But as a baseball fan and a historian, you get to combine what I would think are maybe the top two interests in your life professionally. Is that the fact?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Keith. It's been a terrific opportunity. It was not something I ever planned to do. I always joked around when I started to work for the Reds back in 2003 and 2004, and getting a check from a Major League Baseball team, I'd kind of given that idea up by the time I was about 13 years old. So yeah, it's been a terrific experience, and I think the opportunity to help start the Reds Hall of Fame and to help create a legacy piece for this franchise and for the fans of the Reds has certainly been one of my more satisfying professional accomplishments, yes.
Well, you come by it with credentials as a historian and having worked with the Cincinnati Historical Society, right, for several years. And a historian has to approach things in a little bit different way than just a fan would or a journalist working on a story. Tell me about some of the things that go into putting together and directing this sort of Hall of Fame facility, and how that differs from maybe just a fan being interested in the history and collecting.
Well, one of the things, I mean, you certainly have an obligation to try to make sure that the things that you say, the things that you talk about and write about in the museum as you present things are accurate and up to date, and that certainly occupies a lot of our time around here. And we have terrific resources with the Reds. I mean, from things to terrific photo files that they have to player bios that they've accumulated over the years, to things just like a complete run of Cincinnati Reds programs, mm-hmm. You know, just to find, just to have all that right at your fingertips is terrific. And of course, then we also have, over the years, we've been able to develop a great relationship with a lot of the Reds alumni. And so, on top of all of the archival information, the sort of traditional stuff, we now have a really rich oral history tradition, and we've got stories and so forth to pull from too. So yeah, there's a lot of work that goes in. You know, people come through and they read an exhibit panel and look at something and move on, but there's a lot of stuff certainly that goes on behind the scenes to make sure that panel's the right thing and that piece of equipment or whatever the artifact is telling the story you want it to tell.
Well, of course, it's a unique background for the Reds in that they are the first professional baseball team going back to 1869, and the idea of paying players was new at that point, but I guess a group of business people decided it was time to do that. It's reported, I guess, that some teams were already doing that, but it was kind of under the table. This was a chance to bring it out in the open.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Circumstances there.
We were not the first team to pay players. There are other teams that paid players, but we were the first team to openly put all of our players under contract And back then, by the way, the whole roster was 10. Substitutes were illegal in 1869. So you didn't have to carry a whole big bench, and the pitching was underhand. You only needed really one pitcher. They played about three games a week. So you could get by with a very, very small roster. So they had 10 guys, and they raised about $10,000 in order to cover the payroll, about $1,000 a player. And but you're right about the fact that other teams had already dabbled with the professional idea, but none of them had really committed to it in the way that the Red Stockings did in 1869 and 70. And within a year, by 1871, you have the first professional league. So the idea immediately captured the interest of the other baseball people, and they saw in this what the Red Stockings had put together. They saw in that a path to the future and to making the game a more professional enterprise. It had been an amateur activity largely up to then, and so now we can turn it into a business, and we can turn it into a model that has legs and, you know, can move on. So the 69-70 Red Stockings really were a pivot point in baseball. It was an amateur game, largely an amateur game before that, and it pivoted to a professional game because of the success that they had.
And those salaries that you mentioned, $10,000 to cover the 10-man roster, but in looking back now, I mean, that has been 150-plus years ago now, and to recruit a guy to play baseball professionally and pay him $1,000 for the season, 1869, that was pretty good money, wasn't it?
Yeah, and you know, it was for 9 months. It was a 9-month contract. And that was they were paid very well. Now their salaries weren't nearly as astronomical as they are today. I mean, I think a high school principal in 1870 in Cincinnati probably made maybe $1,500. So they were paid well, but they weren't paid at the upper stratosphere of incomes the way they are today.
And we see sometimes vintage baseball games being played, but for the fans who may not have seen those, if you saw a game being played from that era, would you recognize it as a baseball fan? Is it close at all to today's product?
Well, yeah, you'd recognize it as a baseball game. Of course, you'd be sitting on wooden bleachers with no cover, and you'd be wearing a very hot old wool suit or something like that. I mean, the conditions about in sitting in the stands were certainly very, very far. In fact, if you got there a little late, you probably stood because they didn't have seats for, they only had about maybe 3,000 seats at their little ballpark, and often they drew in excess of 5,000. So there were a lot of standees along the foul lines. But the game itself, there were 9 players on the team. They had 3 outs per side, and the players played roughly in the same positions as they do today, and you would recognize the game. But a couple of the major differences were, what, number one, pitching was underhand from 45 feet, not 60 feet, but 45 feet. And there was no pitcher's mound, or you might be looking for the pitcher's mound, but there wasn't any. They just marked a couple lines out in the center of the diamond there and had the pitcher stand between those two lines to deliver the ball. There was only one umpire during that time period. Who stood behind home plate, and he did not have to call every pitch. So oftentimes he might not call a pitch after the pitcher had thrown 2 or 3 pitches, give the guy a little chance to, you know, find the plate. Or if you were the batter and let a couple of good ones go by, he might warn you and then start calling strikes. But by and large, it was the mentality of the game was for the pitcher to throw the ball in there and let the guy would hit it and run the bases, and we'd all get a lot of exercise and put on a good show for the fans. And they scored a lot of runs. I mean, today, if you had a 10-9 game, that'd be, you know, a lot of runs. They had those games all the time back then. And in fact, the Red Stockings in 1869 averaged 42 runs a game.
Wow.
42 runs a game. You know, a football team would be happy with 42
sure.
runs a game,
yeah.
42 points a game. So it was a very high-scoring affair. Back in that day.
I did see one item in your book, The First Boys of Summer, about a team from Lexington that went up against the Red Stockings and did not come out so well in a high-scoring game, at least for the Red Stockings,
yeah.
It was a high-scoring game. What, 74?
Yeah, there had some games that they played against clubs like the Lexington Club, which would have been an amateur club, might not have practiced very much, probably didn't play that many games. But back then there was no league, so you could schedule anybody you wanted to play. and it counted. And the Red Stockings in the Midwest were by far and away the best team. It'd be like there was only one professional baseball team or one really great baseball team in this whole region. And so all their other competition was inferior. They just were playing clubs that really didn't belong on the same field with them, but they had no choice. I mean, they back then, traveling all the way back east or somewhere else to play baseball, I mean, that was a pretty significant enterprise, train trips overnight and with all the expenses and so forth. So most of the clubs tended to play closer to home. It's just in the case of the Red Stockings, they were so good, they dominated all the local teams. So they had a lot of games where they really ran up the score, but in part, I mean, in part that was because they were really good, but it also had to do with the fact that the competition was pretty unequal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think 74-0 was the final in that one. Don't know if there was a mercy rule in effect in those days, but maybe there should have been. Baseball had its Wright brothers long before the aviation field had its Wright brothers. Tell me about the Wright
brothers. Yeah, I always say when you think about the 1869 Red Stockings, You think about the Wright brothers, but it was Harry and George Wright, not Orville and Wilbur. Harry and George Wright, they are both in the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. They're both in our Reds Hall of Fame here. Harry was the captain of the club, and in that time period, essentially the manager, and in that time period, it was all playing managers, and so he not only was the captain, he also played center field and was a part-time relief pitcher as well. And his younger brother, George, played shortstop and was by far and away the star player in all of America at that time. He was the leading player in the country. And he went on to have a very long career. Harry went on to have an equally long career, although his was more on the managerial side and in the National League offices. But they're both in Cooperstown and So we're founded by the Wright brothers.
Well, I'm sure as a historian, you have a chance to see just exactly any and all media coverage from that era. And there were a lot of newspapers around, but that doesn't mean necessarily that every day was covered. But there were media outlets in the form of newspapers.
Yes. In Cincinnati alone, there were probably half a dozen regular papers. A couple of them in German. Now, I must say, we scanned the German papers to see if we could ever find something that looked like a box score, but we never did, could find it. But there were four English papers in English, and for big games, when a team from the East would come in, one of the stronger clubs out of New York or Philadelphia would come in, and they would draw 8,000-10,000 people to their little ballpark. Usually, all four papers would cover it. So it was a very rich, set of descriptions. I mean, you had four different reporters covering the game, and you'd get four vantage points, and they didn't always match up or agree. But it really, that's what helped provide me with the information to do that first book, was the fact that they covered the team so well. And in 1869, the Red Stockings traveled all the way to the East Coast for a whole month. The whole month of June they were gone, playing on the East Coast. And then in September, they traveled all the way to San Francisco, hard to believe, on the new Transcontinental Railroad, and they were gone on that trip for about a month. And on both instances, they sent a reporter with the team. So you have these wonderful descriptive accounts of the boys in New York and Philadelphia and in San Francisco in 1869.
What a road trip, a month long and traveling by train at that era. Baseball actually, as I understand it now, after the Red Stockings' great success that first year, went away for a little while in terms of professional baseball before coming back to stay a few years later. Right?
They had terrific success on the field, the 1869 and 70 Red Stockings, but they never could quite figure out how to make the money work, the finances work, and they essentially broke even after a couple of years, and the players were now getting opportunities, they were getting offers to go to other places, and it was going to cost the club a lot more money, and they just didn't think they could make ends meet, and so they gave up the ghost. We not only became the first team city to have a professional, fully professional team, but we were the first city to lose one. And so in 1871, we did not field a professional team, and we didn't resume professional ball in Cincinnati until 1876, when the National League formed and a group of local people together got together and sponsored the Reds, a Red Stockings team for the beginning of the National League.
That's interesting when you talk about other markets coming after the most talented players.
Yes, it sounds like today.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to ask you about the Crosley Field era, because you and I are thinking about the same demographic, and saw games as kids at Crosley Field, and what wonderful memories we and thousands of other baseball fans have of that facility. But in order to get to the Crosley Field era, we probably should talk about the predecessors to Crosley Field at that location, because there were several, you might say, iterations of the ballpark before it actually settled in on Crosley Field.
Right, Crosley Field was built in 1912. Was then called Redland Field, because Mr. Crosley didn't buy the club until the 30s. It originally started out as Redland Field. But prior to that, there was three or four other ballparks on that site dating back to 1884. Now, the Red Stockings played on a different site, and your listeners who are familiar with Cincinnati and know the old Union Terminal train station, now the Museum Center, that's roughly where the Red Stockings played their games. And the Crosley site was about eight blocks north of that. And the Reds settled in there in 1884 and played baseball there in a couple of little wooden ballparks. And finally, they built some more substantial ballparks. They opened up Crosley Field in 1912. And its final game was 50 years ago this year, in the summer of 1970.
Yeah. And there was one of those predecessors was called the Palace of the Fans.
The Palace of the Fans.
Design.
Isn't that a great name for a ballpark? They got that nickname. And it was the one that immediately preceded Crosley on the very same site. The biggest problem with that, and that ballpark actually only lasted about a decade. It was just, when they built it, they weren't optimistic enough. They built it too small. Mm-hmm. And baseball really experienced a terrific growth in popularity in the very early 1900s. And by 1912, that ballpark was too small. And the other thing is, too, and you remember this from your days at Crosley, as I do, you would often have to sit behind a pole sometimes. You know, the poles in the middle of the grandstands, that was a very common sight. And I think if you go to Wrigley or if you go to Fenway, you might still have that opportunity. But the pillars, the poles of that old Palace of the Fans were enormous. And they blocked the view almost all the way along the whole front of the grandstand. You had an interrupted view. So it wasn't the best place to see a game, but a very ornate and a wonderful piece of architecture, the ballpark. It's too bad it didn't survive.
Well, once the Reds settled in at Crosley or Redland Field before becoming Crosley in the 30s, fans that were there will remember some of the features of the ballpark that made it unique. And if you unfortunately never had a chance to attend a game at Crosley Field, I guess discussions always start with the terrace, right, in the outfield?
When I was working on a book on Crosley Field, this was 25 years ago, although it's still in print, I will tell you, that book really has had legs. But anyway, when I would go out to talk to people about Crosley Field, the first thing they'd mention would be the terrace. It was so unusual a feature. And for those people not familiar with it, it was out in left field, about 25, 30 feet before the outfield wall, that started up this gradual slope that sloped right up to the wall. And it was part of the natural landscape of the area back when they built the ballpark in 1912. And it just seems like it was always there. They just didn't take it out. The ball club liked it because when they would have an overflow crowd, they could sit the overflow out on that terrace. It sort of was a natural bank of seats, a natural amphitheater like. Mm-hmm. So they kept it there. And over the years, it bedeviled more outfielders.
Yeah.
It was a tough to play that, because that ball hit over your head and you take a few steps back, all of a sudden you're running uphill. Mm-hmm. And it was very tricky. You know, Frank Robinson, I remember saying that he just hated it when he first came to Cincinnati in 56. But after a few years, he got used to it, and then he kind of liked it because he thought it gave the Reds a little bit of an advantage. Because mm-hmm. when the visiting outfielders came in, especially young kids that hadn't played it before, it took them a little bit of time to get accustomed to it.
Yeah, because that was truly unique in the fact that no matter what kind of baseball field you played on, it's very unlikely you played on one that ran you uphill toward the outfield.
Yeah, level. Exactly. Yeah. And there was that big cement wall. The left field wall was a big green cement wall. And boy, you'd start up that terrace, and if you weren't careful, that ball carom off of that brick cement wall be right back in your face in no time at all. There are stories in the mid-30s when Babe Ruth played here in the last year of his professional career, he played in the National League, and he came into Cincinnati, and he was playing left field, and he had some trouble with the terrace and fell at some point and sprained a knee, wrenched a knee, and he ended up retiring a few within a couple of weeks after that. And there's some speculation that the knee injury here at Crosley kind of helped speed that retirement announcement up, although the Babe had been struggling anyway. He's probably going to retire. But nonetheless, it was a tough little, it was a tough outfield to play.
Swinging around to the other side of the outfield for the fans, got the viewpoint from right field. And in daytime, it was called the Sun Deck. At night, it was called the Moon Deck. But the bleacher seats there in right field were also, I thought, a unique feature of Crosley Field. And anybody who's ever spent any time out there probably remembers the good look that it afforded out there.
Yes, and you know, we're sitting doing this interview right in front of a big photo of the outfield of Great American Ballpark, and out there in deep right field, as those fans who have been to the ballpark have seen it, is a somewhat of a tribute to the old moon deck, the old sun deck, out in deep right field in Crosley Field. It was an uncovered bleachers, bleacher seats, and it had a low chain link fence in front of it. And it was the only place in the ballpark where the outfielder could actually go back and jump as high as the fence, because all the other fences were 18 feet high or something. I mean, they were really high, but the one in front of that bleacher, the bleacher seats, was pretty low. So you had a chance to make some dramatic catches out there and some moments. But yeah, that was I think it was 25 cents probably back when we were kids to sit in the sun deck.
Yeah, that was where I got my first look at Frank Howard with the Dodgers playing right field, who at that time was probably the largest human being I had ever seen. And of course, he was just massive for baseball, and went on to a great career, mostly with the Washington Senators, but came up with the Dodgers. And the moon deck got you a pretty good look at Frank Howard and all the other stars that came along too.
Yeah, that's one of the things. You know, it's funny, you think about all the great players who played there at Crosley Field. They had all-star games in the late 30s and in the early 50s. So all the great American League players would have played at Crosley. Mm-hmm. And then you had, of course, everybody who was anybody in the National League for 50 years played at Crosley Field. So there's a lot of ghosts still running around that ballpark in the west end of Cincinnati.
I was going to ask you about one other feature at the ballpark, and I brought along my scorecard from July 25th, 1964.
Yeah, look at that.
I've colored in, I think, some of the pictures on the front, as a 12-year-old might do. But that day I was able to get autographs from Pete Rose of the Reds, of course, and Bill Verdon and Bob Veal of the Pirates. And there was a place at Crosley, and my memory dims a little bit, but where under the stands you could go, and the players passed by that point to get to the dugouts, and occasionally they would stop and sign. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think that's where I was able to obtain these autographs. But tell me about that location.
Well, no, that's exactly right. The clubhouse at Crosley Field was located sort of behind, within the ballpark, but it was behind the lower deck, the lower seating. And so as you came up and walked, so as the players actually walked up through the lower bank of seats, up the walkway, to get to the clubhouse, and you often could stop a player along the way and get an autograph. It was a very unusual feature of the ballpark. And one of the things I think people remember it so fondly is because that sort of intimacy that they felt with the players, and that was part of it, was that ability to get Pete Rose's autograph as he's walking back and forth to the clubhouse. 1964, yeah, that's Pete's second year.
Right.
He debuted in 63. And you would have Frankie Robinson playing back then, and Cheats of the Pirates, you would have Roberto Clemente.
Oh, yeah.
Probably.
Clemente, Bailey, Verdon, Gene Freeze, Don Clendenin,
yeah.
Mazeroski was
still second base
for the Pirates. So
yeah.
Scorecards are wonderful things.
I'm glad
I was not able to throw this one away. I managed to save that.
Well, you're going to be required now to leave that here with the
Is
Hall of Fame.
Right? Well, baseball fans like their statistics and their artifacts, don't they?
They sure do.
They certainly appreciate it. And you mentioned some of the players from that era in particular, but the Reds of the 50s, probably when you may have attended your first games here, power hitting teams. They didn't appear in the World Series, but certainly some great stars that played at that time, and that are some of whom are honored here in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and you know, it was a fairly stable lineup for a number of years. You had Johnny Temple and Roy McMillan in second base and shortstop, and Frank Robinson, of course, joins the team in 56. You had Gus Bell in center field for a number of years. Wally Post was a regular outfielder. Joe Nuxhall on the mound. Sure. Ed Bailey was the catcher for most of the late 50s. So you've kind of had a fairly stable lineup. You got to know the guys over the years. And then, of course, that, as you say, that team did not win a pennant in the 50s. They came very close in 1956. They finished just a couple of games out of the pennant. But it wasn't until 1961 that they won a pennant in that era. They won, of course, back in 39 and 40, but a little before our time.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But the first time, at least I remember as a kid, and probably you, was that 61 pennant.
Sure.
That was a big deal. That was that was a really exciting summer.
That's a chance to bring up the uniforms of the various eras of Reds baseball, and I thought last year, it's hard to imagine a more successful promotion than the throwbacks that they had last year. Everyone seemed to work well, and I thought that was especially a nice uniform from that time, the sleeveless uniform with the red sleeves, and there was a year or two where they put the number above the name on the back, I think, and that would have been Robinson.
Yeah, that would have been in the about 64, 65.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They started to do that. It was a very odd look compared to today,
right?
Because the numbers are above, the numbers are below. But back then, the name was below the number for a couple of years.
But that was sort of the trademark, and Klazuski made the most of it, though, by
cutting
the sleeves off altogether.
Right, right. Big clue. Yeah. And if you come to the ballpark, you'll see a statue out. Of course, out on the Crosley, appropriately named Crosley Terrace, in front of the ballpark, and he's there in the on deck circle, with a bat or two bats, I can't remember now, on his shoulder, and he's got the cut off sleeves,
right.
and that's so appropriate. That's the image that we all have of Clue.
Mm-hmm. And I guess one other feature we should talk about at Crosley was the huge scoreboard in left center field too.
Yeah, the scoreboard was always in left center field at Crosley Field. Even, I mean, from the very first day it opened, they always had a scoreboard out there, but it was much smaller. And then in 1957, I think it was, they built the brand new scoreboard, and it was 50, 60 feet high. It was really tall, and it was in play.
Mm-hmm.
So, which meant that, go back to Frank Robinson, he said that Crosley Field scoreboard cost me 40 home runs in the course
probably
of my
did.
Career.
Yeah.
And later, in the very last years of Crosley, they did paint a yellow line across the scoreboard about 20 feet up to match the height of the center field fence. And then any ball that hit above that yellow line was considered a home run. But for the first decade or so that board was in existence, everything was in play. And probably one of the most famous ones was in the 1961 World Series. Leo Cardenas got robbed of a home run. I mean, he had a ball that was well up, that would have, if it had been 10 feet to the right, it would have missed the scoreboard. It would have been a home run, but it hit off the scoreboard, a double, and then the Reds weren't able to score him, and that would have resulted in either a victory or a tie game. I don't remember exactly, but the point was that big scoreboard turned out to be a very significant factor in run production for the Reds,
mm-hmm.
and not always a positive one.
Right, right. As we move toward the end of the decade, then in the 60s, by that time, approval for a new stadium had been received, I guess, really in the early 60s. It took a long time for things to materialize, but like for nearly every ballpark, it reached the end of its era, but it certainly was a great era for Reds fans and Reds baseball, I would think.
Yes, the ballpark, we played our last game there in June of 1970.
Right.
Riverfront Stadium opened, and Crosley shut down. It was used for a couple of years, they had some concerts in there, and then they started to use it, the city owned it, and used it as an impoundment lot. So they would take vehicles on the abandoned vehicles on the streets of Cincinnati and park them in the infield and the outfield of the ballpark. There's some pictures from that time. It's sad seeing overgrown ballpark with these old junkers all over the field. And then finally, in 72, it was demolished and office light industrial area was built there. But over the years, there's been monuments dedicated at the site. And just recently, about 2 or 3 years ago, a much more significant display was opened. And so if you're in the area and you remember the old location, or you can Google it, that's for sure. You can find it on Google Maps, the old Crosley Field site in the west end of Cincinnati. And there's a nice little walking tour down there now. You kind of walk around and with little plaques to mark significant sites.
Oh, yeah. Well, you have to imagine the memories at that point, but you can.
Right, you can. You can. And you know, it's... people still have very, very fond memories, and if you grew up back in the 50s and 60s, that certainly was, you know, a big part of your life if you were a Reds fan, just as it was if you were in later years going to Riverfront was a big deal.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, of course, we have things like this beautiful Hall of Fame to trigger baseball memories, but we're in the broadcast exhibit as it happens right now, and I always like to pay tribute to the broadcasters in terms of creating our lasting baseball memories, and I guess we should start with the more recent event of Marty Brenneman's retirement, such a big part of Reds baseball for 46 years, and now he'll be around, but not as the full-time broadcaster anymore, and so it's a change.
It will be. I think that, you know, Marty is clearly, I mean, in terms of the pantheon of Reds broadcasters, he's at the top. He just had a terrific career and was recognized by the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. Also, he'll be inducted into our Reds Hall of Fame this coming season. But it is going to be a big change. I mean, you know, you turn it into the game. But I will say one thing. Marty kind of took a little more time off these last 2 or 3 years, yes. So we've had time to sort of get used to the transition. And I think Tommy Thrall and Jeff Brantley will do a terrific job. Big shoes to fill, no doubt about that. But, you know, Marty had big shoes to fill when he came in.
Absolutely.
Al Michaels had been the great Al Michaels had been the Reds broadcaster for 3 seasons, I think, when Marty replaced him in 1974. And then before that, you had Wade Hoyt, mm-hmm. who was the dean of the broadcasters before Marty's tenure. And that's who we grew up with, listening to Wade. And I often credit some of my interest in baseball history to listening to Wade tell baseball stories during his broadcast, during the rain delay, the famous rain delays, when Wade would fill the time to reminiscing about his days with the Yankees and when he played ball back in the 20s and 30s. And yes. And then, of course, Red Barber was also part of that lineup of Reds announcers. So we've really been very lucky here in Cincinnati, have just terrific play-by-play men.
Yeah, and you mentioned Wade Hoyt, and it is true that fans who listen to Wade Hoyt for any length of time at all, you can't talk about him very long before the word rain delay comes up, because that was just where you would hear about the 27 Yankees and all the other stories of his long baseball experience. And he was such a great storyteller that was really his trademark.
Yeah, it's funny when you talk about that era, let's say the 50s and 60s, when you talk to fans about it today, they remember the great players, the Frank Robinsons, the Veda Pinsons, the Klosuskis, and so forth. But the names that often pop up are Wade Hoyt, Paul Summerkamp, who used to be the PA announcer for years, and Ronnie Dale at the Oregon. Mm-hmm. The Crosley Oregon was a big part of the experience of going to the ballpark. And Peanut Jim, who sold peanuts out of it, little roasted peanuts out beyond the outfield wall. And it's funny how those things almost carry as much weight and as much meaning, part of the lore of the ballpark, as the great players and the great games that people saw.
Yeah, I want to ask you about a man too that is very close to a lot of Kentucky fans of that era, and that's Claude Sullivan, who was, in fact, his name is on my scorecard here in 64. I listened to the Reds play-by-play with Wade Hoyt and Claude Sullivan. Yeah. Claude's career, unfortunately, was cut short by the illness that took his life, but he certainly, I think, established himself early as one who was going to go on to a great career. Had that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, had he not been, had the cancer not happened, I mean, you're right. He'd become the second play-by-play man, the color guy in the booth with Waite. And when Waite retired in '65, Sullivan was tapped, and had things worked out differently, he might very well have stayed on in the broadcast booth for a number of years. And I mean, as it turned out, he was replaced by Jim McIntyre, I think, for a couple seasons. And Al Michaels came, and then Marty came. But Claude was an important part of Cincinnati Reds baseball there for a number of years in the mid and late 60s.
Well, Greg, I could talk Reds baseball and the Hall of Fame and history and Crosley Field with you all day long, but we should probably wrap up. And I do want to wrap up by saying that, of course, the historian usually is looking back, but on the other hand, there's a lot of excitement this offseason, too, about what the Reds have done and putting themselves in position to contend or win the National League Central, and I would think that the excitement level, as we are recording in early February, is very high right here.
Oh, it is. I think the Reds have made some great moves this offseason, and I hope we're sitting here a year from now talking about their great run for the pennant and their World Series win. Yeah. Let's see how it goes.
All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate your time.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.